What role did the Christian faith play in the founding of America? Well, to some degree, the answer you'll receive to that question boils down to who you ask. Our guest today is Dr. Mark David Hall, Herbert Hoover Distinguished Professor of Politics at George Fox University, which is in Oregon. He's the co-author slash co-editor of a new book called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. This is a scholarly work. It is put out by Oxford University Press. His co-author is Daniel Dreisbach. And part one is on religion and political culture in the American founding, and part two is on faith and the founders. So, Dr. Hall, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
Sure. So, give us an overview on that. In fact, let me just start with that first question. What role did the Christian faith play in the founding of America? I know it's a controversial subject, and again, it boils down to who you ask. So, I'm asking you.
All right, excellent. I'm happy to take a shot at it. As you know, there's a lot of literature on this subject, and among academics, there tends to be a consensus that religion played very little role, that the American founding is a product of the Enlightenment, that you had people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison that had, you know, maybe they're Christians of some sort, but they really left the Orthodox Christianity, and they were drinking deeply of the wells of the Enlightenment, and they put together a revolution and then a constitution that really didn't draw much at all from our Christian heritage. That's a very common tale. Daniel Dreisbach and myself and several other academics, as well as a number of popular authors, have attempted to challenge that narrative, say, well, wait a minute. First of all, maybe even some of the founders that are oftentimes labeled as Enlightenment thinkers, such as James Madison or John Adams, perhaps they're not quite as enlightened as you think. And certainly, if you expand the conversation beyond the five or six elite, what you'll see is many, many of the founders are drawing deeply from their religious convictions or Christian convictions. And one of the ways we've attempted to make this argument is Daniel and I have edited three books, the first two with Jeffrey Morrison of Regent University, where we've profiled a lot of different founders and a lot of different traditions. And what you find is that when you get beyond a Thomas Jefferson, say, who did, in fact, depart from Orthodox Christianity, at least in the latter part of his life, when you look at the broader constellation of the founders, many of them were pretty clearly Orthodox Christians, who were pretty clearly drawing from the Christian faith. And so that's one of the things we're attempting to show in this and our other books.
Hmm. All right, Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. Now, one of the essays you wrote early on deals with the Reformed tradition, and you point out that, frankly, at the time, even of America's founding, in other words, not the settling era from, let's say, 1607 until 1776, but even at the time of 1776, many, many of Americans, maybe the majority, were going to Calvinistical-type churches. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say certainly a majority. The great students of American religious history, Sidney Ahlstrom and then more recently Skip Stout, have estimated that up to 75% of Americans of European descent, so we aren't talking about Native Americans or African Americans.
Right.
But if you look at white Americans, about 75% can reasonably be said to go to Calvinist church or to affiliate themselves with Calvinist denominations. That, depending on how you count, some that might fall as low as 50%, but that still makes a majority. And this is very important in light of some of these questions. So, for instance, it's very, very common for scholars to say, look at the American Revolution. These guys are drawing from John Locke, whom they believe is a secular thinker, and that's a debatable assertion, but let's just stipulate that might be the case. And John Locke talks about the right to resist tyrants, and this is what Americans are drawing from. Well, one of the things I argue in this chapter is, in fact, Reformed Christians had been arguing for 100 years before John Locke that not only subordinate magistrates, as John Calvin said, but even the people themselves, as John Knox said, have a right to resist tyrannical authority. And so John Locke really is writing within this longer tradition of Reformed political theology. He's drawing from it. Maybe he innovates it in a way that Christians might feel uncomfortable with, but I think my main point in this respect would be most Americans at the time who were Reformed Christians are drawing from this deep tradition of Reformed thinking about politics, not from a secularized John Locke, who really wasn't even all that well known in the American colonies at the time.
Well, and if we go back to England, let's say in the 1600s, they were very tumultuous times, and you had the Civil War. Then you even had a regicide where the king was executed. It's my understanding that those responsible for the execution of the king, and they didn't do this lightly, but they were coming from the Reformed tradition, and they were basically saying, you know, that the king is essentially unkinged himself. And in a sense, maybe there's ways in which this impacts later the American Revolution, 100-and-something years later, 20 years or so later.
Oh, I think it clearly does. And even in the American colonies, you had the colonists resisted Governor Andros, who was sent over to create the Dominion of New England. You had John Cotton preach a sermon defending the killing of the king. Later, after the Restoration, when the English authorities were hunting down these regicides, three of them fled to America, and they were treated as heroes, and they were hid and kept from the British authorities. And so this is of course around the time that John Locke is writing the Second Treatise. But of course, you already have the English Civil War, completely over, right? He's writing during the Glorious Revolution. And so, yeah, these ideas are fully present within Anglo-American political thought, and they have to be attributed, I think, to these early Reformed thinkers, not just the ones we tend to know about, John Calvin and John Knox, but Goodman and Poney and a whole host of folks, author of Windicate Contra Tyrannos, for instance.
Say that. What was that last thing you just said?
It's a famous work by an anonymous author, Windicate Contra Tyrannos, basically a vindication of a right to resist tyrants, where you have this full-throated theory of revolution laid out, again, I think about 100 years before John Locke wrote the Second Treatise.
What was Jefferson's motto?
Resistance to tyrants is obedience to God.
Yeah, that's the same idea.
Absolutely. And he proposes this for the national motto of the United States. And, of course, Jefferson even proposed as our national seal an image of Moses raising his hands as the Jews had fled across the Nile, or the Red Sea, rather, and the Red Sea's coming back on Pharaoh's troops, an explicitly religious symbol. And that's why I say, even with respect, Jefferson was more influenced by the Enlightenment than many founders. He clearly departed from Orthodox Christianity, at least late in life.
Yes.
But even he was not an advocate of the strict separation of church and state. And even he, I think, we can point to ways in which he was influenced by the Christian heritage out of which he came. And this is all more obviously the case with someone like a James Madison or a John Adams, again, who might have not always practiced as Orthodox Christians, and Adams clearly embraces some heretical ideas, but still, I think you can point to some really clear ways in which Reformed political thinking influenced their view of politics.
Sure. Plus, you know, I think what you said about Jefferson changing, that the later Jefferson is different than the earlier Jefferson, I think there is definitely a lot of truth to that, and I think it helps explain how it is that sometimes one group of scholars can look at the Founding Fathers and say, oh, look, they were a bunch of deists. Another person could look at the Founding Fathers and say, oh, look, they're a bunch of Christians. A lot of it boils down to, well, which particular period in their lives are you quoting? It's almost like, well, when they needed God the most, they called on him the most, and they were the most Orthodox and faithful. And then later, once things got established, some of them tended to kind of ease off on that. By the way, George Washington never did, but some of the other ones did. And so I think that helps explain part of the reason that this is not settled science when we're talking about the Christian roots of America.
You know, I think that's right. I would even maybe push back a little on you, though. And I'll tell you a question I've asked a number of scholars. Well, let me set it up in this way. If you ask which civic leaders clearly and publicly rejected any element of Orthodox Christianity, the answer is almost zero. Ben Franklin is a very young man in England, Ethan Allen, and then Thomas Paine, if you count him as an American. These are the only ones that clearly and openly reject any element of Orthodox Christianity. Now, we know from their private writings that Jefferson and Adams did, at least later in life, and you're right to take into account the fact that they might have changed, Other than that, with respect to civic leaders, I'm not sure of anyone that we have a clear record rejecting any element of traditional Orthodox Christianity. As you just suggested, this is the case with George Washington. It's also the case with Alexander Hamilton. It's also the case with James Madison. And, you know, these founders are usually put in this list of deists. And, again, there's just not evidence that they rejected traditional Christianity. And if your definition of a deism includes a God that does not intervene in human affairs, then it's really not clear to me that any of these folks are deists. So, because even Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton talk about God intervening in human affairs. George Washington, of course, does it all the time.
Yes, he does.
And so I would say there's really a great deal of evidence that, you know, sometimes we just don't know about founders because they didn't leave much of a paper trail. But of those that we know something about, the overwhelming evidence is most of them remained Orthodox Christians, that they were Orthodox Christians, that they took their faith seriously. The reports of deism in the American founding are just grossly exaggerated.
Very good. I totally agree. And even Ben Franklin, who did say, you know, as a young man, he rejected Calvinism and just kind of embraced this sort of almost, I don't know, what you call it. Well, let's say he was deist in some ways, let's say. He certainly is not an Orthodox Christian. And yet, even he said on June 28th, I remember the date because that happens to be my wedding anniversary, but 1787, during the Constitutional Convention, he got up and gave this impassioned plea for prayer. And it's a beautiful statement. And, you know, I have lived so a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this, that God governs in the affairs of men. And, you know, he just goes on and on. And it's fantastic call for prayer. And, wow, that's from a deist.
Yeah, and you know, clearly, and your earlier comment applies very well to him. I think what you saw is, as a young man, he really kind of went off the deep edge, but almost right away, even as a young man, he recognized, okay, this is too far, too fast, it's dangerous, and he seems to have drifted back towards the end of his life, where he's maybe best characterized as an agnostic, as, you know, sometimes people do when they mature, they recognize, okay, maybe, you know, I actually don't have evidence to show that God doesn't exist, or that Jesus Christ wasn't God and such. And I have a nice thing I'll add to your story about his impassioned plea in the Constitutional Convention. I think it's very telling that right after he made that impassioned plea, and sometimes scholars would say, well, he wasn't serious, but it's telling to me that this plea was seconded by Roger Sherman, the old Puritan from Connecticut, and no one, even the most atheist of scholars, doubts that Sherman is a committed, pious Calvinist. His minister was Jonathan Edwards Jr. He was a ruling elder in his church. He wrote sermons. He, you know, there's just no question about Sherman. It's obviously Sherman took him seriously, whatever might have been in Franklin's mind. And I think there's good reason to believe that Franklin had shifted throughout his life, so he was certainly more open to God's providence.
All right, we're talking right now with Mark David Hall. He has co-edited a book with Daniel Dreisbach called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. Is there a website for the book or just Amazon.com?
It's published by Oxford University Press. It's easily available on Amazon. And I would say, although Oxford University Press is a university press, I think the chapters are very accessible. I think any interested lay reader could read this volume and our earlier volumes for fun and profit.
Sure. All right. Please get closer to the phone, if you would. I appreciate that.
Okay.
For your microphone.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you. Comment about church attendance during the colonial era, specifically, let's say, around the time of the American Revolution. I once heard an atheist argue, well, only 4% of the American colonies went to church at the time of the American Revolution. Now, I heard another scholar supposedly said, no, it's more like 60%. The atheist, by the way, was not necessarily a scholar. It was just somebody spouting off, I think.
Sure. Yeah, this idea that many Americans in the late 18th century didn't attend church can be traced back to the early 20th century. It became most prominently known with the work of Finke and Stark, two sociologists, in The Churching of America. And they argue that, I think the figure is around 19% of Americans in the founding era regularly attend church. That study is widely quoted. It's all over the place, but it's been thoroughly debunked by very good scholars, by Jim Hudson at the Library of Congress, by Bishop Bonomi, and they say there's all sorts of methodological flaws and no person with any integrity could cite that, should cite that study anymore. What you find is that, first of all, it's often hard to document, right? We're missing a lot of, we simply don't have attendance rolls. We can sometimes show, you know, how many people had joined churches. But one thing that's critically important to remember is oftentimes, particularly for the Reformed churches, it was very difficult to join a church. So one might attend regularly and not formally join. And there's all sorts of difficult issues. So I think the best figures are between about 60% and 80% of Americans in this era, of white Americans, I need to qualify that, could be classified as churched, 80% being the figure from New England, and it drops as you head south. But it's still pretty high. Now, this doesn't mean everyone is going to church every Sunday. You know, some people live 12 miles from church, and so they might not get there regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that Americans in the late 18th century were not particularly religious is, or were not particularly active in church is just false. And let me even mention this. I think some of the best, and I'm sure you and your listeners are aware of this notion of the first Great Awakening in the early 18th century. And the second Great Awakening in the early 19th century. A number of scholars are starting to even question that. They said, really, there's a series of revivals that are going on in America from the early 18th century well into the 19th century, and they were just sort of ongoing. They would pop up here, then they would maybe fade down here and pop up there. And these were going on during the 1780s and 1790s. So it's just simply outdated history to say that Americans in the late 18th century had somehow become secularized, and then, boom, they become Christian again in the 19th century.
But if you had to put a statistic, okay, that one statistic you said is definitely not accurate was too low, that was 19%. In other words, 19% of Americans would go to church on a regular basis mm-hmm. in colonial America. What would that number be that roughly would go?
Well, I'll answer that, but then I want to qualify my answer.
Okay.
I would say the answer probably 60 to 80%.
All right.
Somewhere in there. But I would say, I think that somewhat is the wrong question, and I say that for this reason. As someone who lived a good part of his life in the Bible Belt down in the American South, I knew a lot of people who would attend church that weren't particularly serious about their faith.
Mm.
On the other hand, I think it's a case that some people that might not attend church with regularity might in fact be shaped in important ways by their faith. And so I'll give you one great example, I think. James Madison, clearly brought up as a pious young man, went to Princeton,
mm-hmm.
stayed an extra year to study with President Witherspoon.
Mm-hmm.
But something seemed to happen, and later as an adult, he seems to have not attended church with a great deal of regularity. And yet when you read his work, you find that he's profoundly influenced, I think,
mm-hmm.
by a Christian conception of human nature, at the very least, right? He writes in Federalist 51,
mm-hmm.
if men are angels, government wouldn't be necessary. But men aren't angels, and so we need government, and moreover, we need separation of powers and checks and balances in federalism, and he goes on. And he plays an important role in designing these political institutions. I would say even, let's say a scholar comes along and documents that Madison just avoided church for 10 years in the 1780s, I would say, well, that's kind of interesting and too bad, but that doesn't mean he wasn't profoundly influenced by Christian ideas. This in contrast to the Enlightenment ideas at the time, which basically held that humans are naturally good mm-hmm. and that we should have a centralized government with no checks and balances and no separation of powers, and the government should be run by educated experts. Americans, just almost to a person, rejected this sort of Enlightenment approach to politics, and had, I think, a much more Christian-influenced view of human nature, which led to the constitutional system which we enjoy to this day.
By way of full disclosure, I've been working on a book that I'm co-authoring with Dr. Mark Belisles on the subject of the faith of Thomas Jefferson, and I've been shocked to see that basically whenever Episcopalian worship was available to him, he always attended. And even many times when it wasn't even available, he did go to other Christian churches of sorts. He went to the services at the U.S. Capitol that were held on a regular basis. I mentioned that to a friend of mine, and he said, well, what about the separation of church and state? I said, look, they had those worship services in the U.S. Capitol from around 1800, you know, the beginning of the Capitol, until about the 1880s. They did not have the same understanding that people have today about the so-called separation of church and state, which in some minds, I think, like with the ACLU, it's more like the separation of God and state. And I think even the liberal ones among the founding fathers would not countenance the separation of God and state.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. And even Jefferson, of course, famously pens his letters to the Danbury Baptists, where he talks about a wall of separation between church and state. He penned that, the final version of that, the day before he went to the church services in the U.S. Capitol building, where he heard John Leland, the great Baptist itinerant minister and himself an opponent of established churches, preach. And so I think even Thomas Jefferson, and I do think Jefferson wanted a greater separation of church and state than other founders, than most other founders, but even he didn't mean what the ACLU today means.
Right.
And again, if you expand the conversation, if you go beyond Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, what you see is a vast majority of founders didn't want anything approximating a wall of separation between church and state. And they were really quite comfortable with having the state, and particularly the state or local government, encourage and protect Christianity.
Hmm.
Now, of course, we might, you know, want to think about what this means today in our increasingly pluralistic country. But back in the late 18th century, you had something like, boy, it's about 99% of white Americans are Protestant, right? About 1% are Roman Catholic. You have about 2,000 Jews in America. And so you have a thoroughly, in terms of self-identification, a thoroughly Christian country. And so you simply don't have the problems of, say, states requiring church attendance or encouraging Christianity or funding religious schools that you might today.
All right, we're talking right now with Mark David Hall, co-author, co-editor of a book called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. How about a few comments on the Declaration of Independence? Then I want to talk to you about the impact of Christianity on the Constitution and do the same on the Bill of Rights, if we have time. But let's start with the Declaration of Independence. Are there Christian ideas captured therein? And I certainly believe there are, but I want to hear it from you.
Oh, I absolutely think there are. And I think the reason that some scholars are misled is because they insist on reading the Declaration of Independence in light of what we know about Thomas Jefferson's private thoughts, particularly those private thoughts articulated late in life. If we understand the Declaration properly, we need to understand that it's a product of a community, right? Initially,
yes.
A committee of five, which includes Roger Sherman, the incredibly orthodox Latter-day Puritan. You know, Jefferson did do a draft. Here's an interesting piece of trivia. One reason he did the draft is there are three pretty important committees in 1776, the Board of War, which is probably the most important, right?
The Board of War? Okay.
The committee to draft the Declaration, and the committee to draft the Articles of Confederation. Roger Sherman is placed on all three of those committees, which somewhat reflects his standing at the time. He's a very important guy, right? He's serving on these three important committees.
Yes.
Young Thomas Jefferson is only on one committee, the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence. Now, to be fair, he is a better wordsmith than Sherman, but the reason he had the time to come up with the initial draft is he didn't have as much to do. But Jefferson comes up with the initial draft, the committee comes together, and they change his draft in ways that Jefferson doesn't like. And then the draft, of course, goes to the Congress as a whole, which change it further. And so I would emphasize that the Declaration is a product of a community that had a heck of a lot of Reformed Christians and Orthodox Christians in it. Precious few folks that even lean towards deism, like a Thomas Jefferson. So I would say the only appropriate way, if you talk to everyone in that Congress, if you go back in time and talk to them, and if you said, what do you mean by nature's God? Thomas Jefferson might have said, well, maybe a deistic creator. But I would say almost everyone else in Congress would say, well, this is obviously the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right?
Right.
The Christian God, the God. And you find language like this in all sorts of other texts, including Reformed texts. Isaac Watts speaks of nature God. Isaac Watts, the father of English hymnody. It's just simply wrongheaded to read the Declaration in light of the private views of Thomas Jefferson. Again, I think it's much more accurate, and I argue this in my chapter, to read it in light of this long tradition of reform political thinking, which says that government is based on the consent of the governed, that people have rights, that the people can rise up and overthrow a tyrant if the rights are violated. It's best read as a reform document, not a product of the Enlightenment.
Excellent. And, you know, we could add to that, too, and you really hinted on this, but the later private doubts of Thomas Jefferson, when you look at his religious writings, even during that period of his life, for example, a year later, that was 1776 that he wrote the Declaration of Independence, the first draft. 1777, he wrote up an agreement for, a particular church. In fact, it was called the Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville, Virginia, and they had a very reformed pastor, the Reverend Charles Clay, who was both an Anglican and also he was an evangelical, which made him a minority within Episcopal or Anglican pastors in Virginia at that time. And Jefferson gave more money than any other single person, layperson within that church. So here he supported the ministry of this guy. Now, later, did he have doubts? Absolutely. You could see that in some of his private correspondences. But to impose the Jefferson of, let's say, 1803 or 1813 or whatever into the Jefferson of 1776 itself, just that itself, I think, is a mistake of, you know, of historical misreading there. All right. I think we've beaten that like a dead horse. Let's talk about the Constitution. How about what role does Christianity play in the Constitution? We certainly see, as you alluded to earlier, the view that man is basically sinful, therefore, you know, divide the powers. Boy, that is so clear in the Constitution. What else is there as far as God and the Constitution?
Yeah, first of all, I think that's just incredibly important. I think there's a variety of other things as well. One classic mistake, you know, some scholars, Isaac and Moore, have this book, The Godless Constitution, right? But what this neglects is the American founders were convinced almost to a person that to the extent to which governments are going to have anything to do with promoting religion and morality, that this would be done by the state government, not the national government. So the national government is charged with very few things, right?
Yes.
You see them in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so I think we need to be careful to read the Constitution in light of what it was actually intended to do, and not as sort of the summation of the founders' views of the role of the state. I think some of them were incidentally coming to question whether or not it's good for Christianity to have, say, an established church. And most Americans that ended up opposing establishments rejected this notion that they argued it actually hurts establishments. I think the fact that humans are created in the image of God and therefore are capable of reasoning together and of self-government is very important. This also informs Americans' idea of equality. And this is beginning to play out with respect to slavery. You see in the Constitutional Convention some founders that are adamantly opposed to this institution. After 1776, a number of the northern states voluntarily end slavery. And I think this is driven by this idea that, and a pretty obvious idea, right, that we are all created in the image of God, and therefore it doesn't make sense to have one human own another. The notions of liberty are profoundly influenced by Christianity and Christian ideas. The founders, to a person, distinguished between liberty and licentiousness. And so we have to understand certainly the Declaration's references to liberty, the First Amendment's references, in light of this bounded notion of liberty, not the excessive individualistic view that we have today. So those are just some of the few ways in which I think you can show that Christianity had an influence on the Constitution.
And the Bill of Rights, since you alluded to that as well.
Absolutely.
Sure. Well, how about a concluding thought? And let me just set this up. We've been talking with Mark David Hall, co-author, co-editor of a book called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic, Oxford University Press. Sometimes when you talk about this issue, people will say, yeah, well, that's not what the scholars say. Well, look at these scholars. How about a concluding thought here on faith and the founders of the American Republic?
Sure, if I may, and I hope it doesn't sound too self-promotional, but we have three books, The Founders on God and Government, Religion and the Forgotten Founders on Religion and Public Life, and Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. Every one of the authors of every one of the chapters is a very, very good scholar, willing to take religion seriously, not always Christians. Some of them are Jewish, some of them are atheists themselves, but they're good scholars willing to take religion seriously. And what you see when you expand the conversation beyond a few elite founders to look at the broad constellation of founders, you see a large number of Orthodox Christians who are drawing from their Christian convictions as they fight a war with Great Britain and go about establishing a constitutional republic.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark. David Hall, thanks for this book and thanks for your time. All the best to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jerry.
Sure. God bless. Bye-bye.